This is a warning. I repeat, this is a warning. Your brain may explode from listening to this show. We will not be held responsible if it does. What are you going to do about it anyway? You won't have a head. You've been warned. And now, welcome to the Racer X Podcast Show with Steve Mathis.
Hey everyone, this is Steve Mathis. Thanks for listening to the Racer X Podcast Show. Before we begin the show, I just wanted to give a little shout out to my new friends at BTOSports.com. BTOSports.com has teamed up with yours truly to provide you podcast listeners with a cool free deal. What you want to do is go to BTOSports.com and check out all the sweet stuff from Fly Racing, Fuel Graphics, O'Neill, Stella, FMF, Leot, and Vortex. They carry these lines along with pretty much anything else that you need for your bike or body. So you go there. The cool thing is, you order more than $100, and really, what's $100 these days? James Stewart has that much in his Lambo ashtray. Anyways, order more than $100, type in the offer code Mathis, M-A-T-T-H-E-S, in the coupon section, right when you're checking out, and you'll get a special deal. It's so special, they haven't even really told me yet what it is. So to recap, go to BTOSports.com, spend $100, type in Mathis in the coupon section upon checkout, and get some kind of hella super sweet deal. Remember to check out their closeouts at BTOSports.com is a proud sponsor of the BBMX race team. All right, on to this week's show.
This is David Pingree Meow, and you're listening to the Racer X Meow Podcast Show Meow. Meow.
Welcome to the Racer X Podcast Show. I'm your host, Steve Mathis. I want to thank our sponsor, BTOSports.com, who's joined us on board for a little promo there. I urge you guys to shop there, and I urge you guys to listen to this. An American motocross icon, and this is Marty Smith. Marty, how you doing?
Excellent. How you doing, Steve?
I'm good. I don't throw around the word icon to anybody. I want you to know that. So,
well, I appreciate that.
And actually, for some of the people who are wondering about this, you and I have some history, don't we?
Oh yeah. Shoot, I think it must go back to the early 80s. Back, I think I came up and visited you guys in, was it Winnipeg?
90s, yeah, in the 90s. Winnipeg, yeah, in 91 and 92, I think.
Yeah.
For the people listening there, Marty obviously is known for his motocross schools and, his stellar racing career. But Marty somehow got roped into coming up to Winnipeg, Canada, where I live, to teach some schools. And I don't know how it worked out, but I was in charge of you. I had to find you a bike and cater you around and take you places, and you met my family and came in. And then the next previous year, you taught us a couple of schools. And then the next year, do you remember me coming down to your place and staying down there?
Oh, yeah.
For like a month?
Yeah, that you raised havoc with my family. I remember that.
Yeah, that was crazy. I was down there on a vacation, and my parents were like, hey, you just want to stay back and ride with Marty Smith? And I'm like, yeah. And I had to take a bus back from your place. You dropped me off at the bus station. I take a 3-day bus trip back to Winnipeg. And let me tell you, that bus trip really sucked, but I was glad to hang out with you and ride at Palm Avenue. And I remember it like it was yesterday. It was so cool to do that. So.
Oh, that's bitching. That's bitching. Yeah, you know, that place, Palm Avenue, was a lot of guys rode there. I brought a lot of guys there, a lot of guys that were at the time up-and-coming pros that, ended up riding Supercross or Nationals rode at Palm Avenue. And,
mm-hmm.
of course, all the guys from the San Diego area, you know, myself, Ricky Johnson, Brock Lover, Ronnie Lachine, Tripes, Croft, we all rode at Palm Avenue one time or another.
Yeah, it was so cool for me to spend time with a legend like you. And I remember one of your twisted games was like a tag game where you actually hit the dude. We would try to hit each other and then, you know, chase the other guy around. And I was thinking to myself, this doesn't seem safe, but Marty Smith says it is, so I'm going to do it.
Yeah, you know what? We played that a lot back then, and mm-hmm. It's a pretty good drill. It's a really good drill, and when you think about how we did it, it was probably it could have been dangerous, but it was highly supervised by
yes.
me, of course.
Yes, of course. What do you remember about Winnipeg? I know it's like 20 years ago now, but what do you remember?
Well, you know, I remember that the people were really friendly. The dirt was really dark and loamy. It was bumpy. Tracks had some fun jumps on it. and just the hospitality. You guys showed me a real good time and showed me a lot of hospitality. It was a great couple trips.
Yeah, and now let's talk. Now, obviously, I didn't make it as a pro rider. Clearly, here I am interviewing you. But what do you remember about my skills? Can you think back?
I try to forget those things.
Oh, man.
No, just kidding. everybody that I rode with in my schools, you know, they were all there. They all had one common denominator as far as I was concerned, and that was most of them had heart. And you were right in there with that, Steve. You had a ton of heart, and you had a ton of ambition and a ton of drive and just a lot of love for the sport. And you know, that's something that nobody can ever take that away from you, Steve.
Oh, thanks, Marty. I appreciate it. Man, these schools, how long have you been doing these things for? It's 2009.
What? Well, I've been teaching for, 27 years.
Damn. Wow.
Teaching motocross schools. My first school was in 1983 at mm-hmm. Saddleback Park here in California.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. And, really one of the innovators of the motocross school, right? One of the first guys to really do it.
Well, you know what? When I started schools, there was a guy named Russ Darnell.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm not sure. Rolf Tiblin.
Oh, yeah?
Rolf Tiblin, yeah, he was one of the very first guys, if not the first. And so, yeah, I was probably one of the pioneers when it comes to motocross schools, and it was something that I never really wanted to do. It just kind of evolved in that. You know, I had retired from racing in 83,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I had a lot of people would approach me probably every week and say, hey, why don't you do motocross classes, teach a class, you know? And I didn't have no interest in it. And finally, you know, I got enough grief from everybody. Dude, you got to do it. So
uh-huh.
I didn't really know how to teach. I didn't know how I was going fast or, you know, what made me do what I did. But I just started teaching, and it evolved into what it ended up now, which is it's been a career for me. It's been another career.
Yeah, really. And what's funny is that, you know, a lot of these kids, they don't know you from your racing. They just know you as the motocross school guy, probably, you know, which is amazing. It's how long you've been doing it for.
Well, you know, it's really funny, too, Steve, is it's evolved into the second and third generation, you know.
Right.
Back in the day, back in the early 80s when I was teaching, guys would come to me that were fans of mine that had watched me race and come to see me at all different tracks, whether it be Supercross or outdoors, and you know, they would say, oh, now Marty's teaching schools. You know, whether they really wanted to learn or not, they would want to come ride with me.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's how I got business back in the day. And then as it evolved into the 90s and into the early 2000s, these guys that came to my school, well, they have kids now that are racing, and they are still fans, and they want to send their kids to my school.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So now, in the 90s and the early 2000s, I got my fans' kids that came to my school. And now we're going into 2010, and I've got the vet riders, which are the guys that were my fans that came back in the early 80s that were just kids. Well, now they've gone through the period of raising a family, running a company, or running a business or securing themselves in a company, and now they've got time to where they can be a vet rider, and the vet class, as you know, is really big each
mm-hmm.
weekend, and now these guys are coming back to me as a vet rider, so it's like a third generation client.
I don't know if that's inspiring or depressing, right?
Hey, you know, I'm totally inspired by it because, you know, I feel like I take pride in my condition, and I can go out there and I can ride with just about anybody. You know, I can't ride with these young kids now, the top pros, of course, but anybody else. You know, I can hold my own. I still feel like I'm comfortable with all the jumps
mm-hmm.
and take good care of yourself. And I totally take pride in it, Steve.
Yeah, no, that's cool. That's awesome. How do you feel the motocross school industry is going? I feel like it's kind of died down in the last little while.
The motocross school industry?
Yeah, like just I remember there was an explosion and there was a ton of guys doing it, and it's almost like the herd has been thinned and it leaves sort of you and Gary and Tony D kind of still doing it, and maybe some guys have come and gone. You know what I mean?
Well, in actuality, Steve, my point of view on motocross schools and motocross teachers, and you'll probably get this from if you talk to Gary or Tony, what really goes on when it comes to being a motocross instructor is It starts way back in a guy's early days of riding. A guy will ride for fun, and as he gets older, he'll turn into maybe a young pro, and he'll want to make a career at it. So the mom and dad will say, okay, look it, we're going to homeschool this guy because we want him to have the best opportunity to be a factory rider. Well, the kid goes through homeschool, and as it turns out, they go to homeschool, and when they should be doing homework during the week, they're riding, or the parents get busy and they don't end up doing all the work, the homework, and the kids really aren't learning anything.
Right.
And what happens is they turn pro, and they didn't really go to school. They went to homeschool, which, again, they learned nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And as they turn pro and they didn't make it, what happens is after their racing career, they want to start a new career, but they really don't have a clue what to do because a lot of these guys just don't have a lot of savvy as far as the outside world. All they know is motocross, and all they know is how to ride, how to train. So they say to themselves, okay, well, look, I don't know anything. What can I do? Well, I'm going to be a motocross teacher.
Right.
So that's why in the last 10 years there's been a huge rash of motocross teachers, because these are guys that basically rode motocross that maybe never made a career of it or couldn't make a living out of it, and they don't know what else to do, Steve. So they're a motocross teacher. They're just an automatic motocross teacher because that's all they know.
Right.
That's all they know. They don't know construction. They don't know electronics. They don't know carpentry. They don't know. They pretty much don't know anything because they were raised to ride a motorcycle, and that's all they know.
Yeah. No.
And that's why there's been a rash of motocross teachers. And unfortunately, you're going to run across a lot of guys that are motocross teachers that have no qualification and no skills to be that.
Right. And I mean, for yourself doing it, almost 30 years, surely you've gotten better as the time's gone on, I'm sure. And now you've kind of refined your act. What do you find most people do? What's the most common mistake you see? And I mean, I know it's kind of vague, but just off the top of your head.
No, that's an easy one, Steve. There's a couple things people do. They sit down too much, and they sit. Sometimes they sit too far back in the seat. That's a common one. Very few of the guys ride in the balls of their feet. They all ride in their arches.
Right.
A lot of the guys don't hold on with their knees. They wonder why their upper body gets so tired, and a big portion of them aren't re-gripping. There's so many things that guys don't do. Even the young pros, the guys that are riding the pro class, they have problems with the same sort of stuff. They sit down too much. It just goes on and on.
Do you notice four strokes making riders lazier? Because I think they do.
Well, I don't know if it's four strokes that make guys lazier, but I know that the big bike, the big 450, you get a guy that normally rides a 250 or a 125, 250F, whatever the case may be, and then all of a sudden he gets on a 450. 450 has power in any gear and pretty much any RPM. All they got to do is just play with the clutch a little bit. It makes a guy very lazy to ride a 450, but to go get on a 450 and go race a 450 and be competitive in a pro class, that's a different story.
Yeah. No, good points for sure, no doubt about it. Before we get too far, where can people go to learn more about your schools?
I'm sorry, I lost that, Steve. What'd you say?
Where can people go to learn more about your schools on the web?
The easiest way is martysmithmotocross.com.
Okay, all right.
I've got a bitchin' website. They can check it out. There's a trailer there, a small two-minute trailer of my motocross DVD.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of which, I saw you call your MX files a while back. That was awesome. That had to make you feel pretty good to be part of that, huh?
Love it. Absolutely. Todd Huffman's incredible.
Yeah, he's done a great job with those shows, no doubt about it. And, man, your Lucas Oil commercial, you're blowing up.
Hey, you know what? It's I'm really thankful, and I'm really honored that the industry still keeps me involved. And it kind of goes back to back in the day when I was a factory rider. I always stayed back. I signed autographs for people. I never pushed people aside. And People remember that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's always been good to me. This sport's been very, very good to me.
Yeah, it has, definitely. I know a lot of people still talk about your heyday as being their introduction to motocross, you know what I mean? And I did one of these with Glover, and he had nothing but good things to say about you. You were kind of his hero, you know, when he was a kid. So
Brock's a good guy, and we go way back. Shoot, we go way back,
yeah.
Brock and I.
Do you travel much for your schools?
Not really,
no.
Steve. I'm going to Houston to Rio Bravo December 5th
mm-hmm.
for a school back there. But I normally stay out. That's about as far as I go. Texas is about as far as
yeah,
I care
yeah.
to go. I turned into a homebody these days.
Well, you live in beautiful San Diego. I don't blame you.
Yeah.
Hey, I saw you at the U.S. Open being interviewed on the big screen there.
And
what do you think of the races nowadays when you come around? I see you in Anaheims and stuff. Well, what's your take on it?
Well, my take is that, you know, without question, the sport has gotten a lot more dangerous. When it comes to the riders, I don't think the riders have the heart today.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure I'm correct on this. And the guys that come back from my era, they'd pretty much agree. They'd back me up on that one, that the riders, the majority of the riders just don't have the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have the dedication that it takes. I mean, come on, Steve. These guys, some of these guys that are winning the races, you know, like Ricky and Bubba and Chad and, you know, some of these other guys, they're lapping up to third, fourth, fifth place.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these guys are out there, and it's almost like they're just happy to be at the show, and they don't really care if they're getting lapped. I mean, how slow, how much off the pace do you got to be to get lapped and still get a fourth or fifth place? How far off the pace are you, Steve?
Yeah.
That's incredible. And
it is.
As far as I'm concerned, if I got a fourth or fifth place or third place and I got lapped, there's no way in hell I'd be happy with that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be disgusted. I'd be embarrassed to show up the next week.
Certainly we don't have the parity in our sport that we did back in your day, you know, with everybody going at it, or even the 80s, even the mid-80s, you know.
Back in the 70s, there was 10 guys that could win the race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree with that. You don't see that anymore. It's James and Bubba, James and Chad are on another level, you know. And what is it, though? What makes those guys so much better? What
they
do you
want
think?
It. They want
Is that
it?
It?
They want it.
Okay.
They just want it worse than everybody else.
Right,
and,
right.
And I know that when it comes to training, these guys train their butts off.
They do.
They really do. And to be honest with you, if you saw what Bubba and Chad and say Villopoto, some of these guys, what they're doing for training, I just don't understand why the rest of the guys aren't out there doing the same thing, because really it isn't that big of a secret, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these guys, to be better than everybody, you got to do more than everybody.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take anybody a big genius to figure that part out. And these guys that are riding around in seventh, eighth, ninth place year after year after year, it's like, you know, maybe the first year, second year, third year in the pro class, maybe you haven't figured it out yet, but after two or three years in the pro class, and you're still riding around in 7th, 8th, 10th, 15th place, I mean, come on, guys, figure it out.
Is it part of it the money? Because you know the money nowadays is insane compared to levels that you were making, and you were highly paid back in the day. So is it that it? Are the guys just taking the money, you think?
No, really, Steve, like I said,
it's work.
Guys are just happy to be out there.
Right, right.
They love just being a part of the program.
Mm-hmm.
They love just being there. They love getting their gear on, walking through the pits, kind of playing the role, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And you know what I'm talking about. It's a sad deal. They're out there for the wrong reasons.
Right, right.
You know, and like I said, these guys are out there riding around in 20th place and 30th place you know, they're acting all cool. It's like, oh, I'm badass, you know. But then when they get to the start line, their tails are between their legs, and they're coming out 25th, 30th place again. But walking around through the pits during the week, they're all the tough, cool pro guys, you know.
Yeah,
it's just out there. They're out there for the wrong reasons.
Okay. Have you ever trained any of the pro guys? Have you been approached? Have you tried to break into that area? Have you thought about it, et cetera, et cetera?
You know, Steve, that's an era that, honestly, I don't have time for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of traveling that's involved. There's a lot of being away from my family that would involve that.
Right.
And I just can't do it. I've always been one of these guys that I've never been into just, you know, strictly making money and looking to make money my whole life. That,
mm-hmm.
That's not my deal. My deal is to live happy and live comfortable and spend as much time with my family as I can. And in order to do that, it would probably make it almost physically impossible to teach some of these pro guys to go to the races and be with them during the week as much as I am and still keep my normal clientele. It just...
Yeah.
It just it just wouldn't be possible. But as far as pro guys, yeah, you know, shoot, Ryan Hughes has been a student of mine years back. Jeremy was a student of mine back when he was about 13.
Mm-hmm.
I had Casey Johnson, Casey Lytle, Robbie Bell. You know, the list goes on. There's not a lot of, again, my focus has never been to go after the pro guy. But
right.
if pro guys do need help, absolutely, I'm there.
Yeah, because I thought you were involved with Motorsport Outlet a little bit when they first got on the scene years ago, like 5-6 years ago, but maybe not. That's why I asked.
No, you know what? I worked with Motorsport Outlet for a couple years, Tiger Lacey and those guys.
Yeah.
And Sean Collier, those guys were a good bunch of guys, and it was really tough. There again, I had to go to every single national and all the Supercross.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it hurt my normal local clientele here in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really where my business is. And if you combine that with the pain of being gone every week and being away from my family,
yeah,
it just wasn't worth it. And I had to put a stop to it.
Right, right. And how often do you get out on a bike right now just to ride?
I ride the bike usually about 3 or 4 days a week, teaching.
Yeah, yeah. You go to Barona a lot? You go a lot of out there?
I go to Barona. There's a new track out here called Campo.
Uh-huh.
Still go up north a little bit to Star West and Paris and Elsinore. But if I can stay close down here to San Diego, I do.
Have you seen Dogger out? I guess he's dropped a bunch of pounds.
Oh, man. Hey, Ronnie looks really good. Ronnie
good
has
for
dropped
him.
About Ronnie's dropped probably 40 pounds. Maybe, shoot, I don't know. He just looks really good. He's going fast on his bike.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, but I thought he was going to ride that Vet World Championship. I don't know if he did or he didn't. But
I don't think he did. I got some buddies that went, so they never said
I thought
anything.
He was training for that thing, but he's riding really well right now, and he's got his life together, and he's got his head together, and I'm pretty proud of him. He's a good kid.
Yeah, he is. He's a good kid, you call him. That's funny. That's how you remember him, right?
Yeah.
Let's talk about your career a little bit, unless you got anything else to say about your schools or anything like that. But anything else? You just want to talk about your career?
No, I would just like to say that now my son's 20 years old, and he rode racing. You know, started racing all the way up until he was just about ready to turn pro last year, and then
mm-hmm.
we decided against it. And so he's been helping me out in my schools quite a bit, and you know, I can't even begin to keep up with him. He's on another level.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's been a lot of fun. We have a blast riding together, and he helps me out quite a bit, like I said, when it comes to my schools.
Right, right. Oh, that's cool. Yeah, father, son. Nice.
Absolutely.
He was probably a baby when I was around. I was there in like 92 or whatever. So.
Yeah, he was born in 89.
Oh, geez. Wow. Let's talk about your career. And I mean, it was a great one at that. I mean, 3 national titles. But one thing I wanted to talk about, and I remember talking to you about this 20 years ago, was the 1976 season. You raced the 125 Nationals and the 125 World Grand Prix. I mean, that's insane to think about nowadays. I don't know if that's ever been done. It's never been done since. I don't know if it was ever done before. I mean, that had to have been just nuts for you.
You know, it was never done until I did it, and it's never been done since I did it. It was crazy, and I think part of the reason is twofold. One is, in 74 and 75, I dominated the Nationals out here, and there was
mm-hmm.
we pretty much didn't have anybody to run with us.
Right.
And in 76, unfortunately, we had a bike in 76 that we had nothing but mechanical problems with all season.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the beginning of the 76 season, Honda says, hey, are you interested in riding the GPs? Well, to ride a GP circuit was probably one of the most sought after classes you could ride,
right.
if you want to look at it that way.
Yeah.
So I said, absolutely, I'll ride the GPs. And they said, well, that's good, but we want you to ride the Nationals too. Can you think you can pull it? And I said, well,
right.
Let's give it a shot. And they said, okay, this is what we're going to do. They entered me in half the GPs.
Mm-hmm.
And we did all the Nationals and half the GPs. And basically, it ended up running across the whole GP season, but we had select GP events. We'd have two here, one there, three there, two
right.
there type of thing. And, you know, it wasn't as hard as people thought.
Really?
I wasn't. You know, I flew back and forth each week.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I'd stay there 2 or 3 weeks, and I'd come back here for 2 or 3 weeks. The ones that were tough, Steve, was when I'd have to fly to Europe after a national. I'd leave a national, jump on the plane, fly to Europe, and ride a GP that following week,
yeah.
jump on a plane, come back to USA the next week. Those were the tough ones.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, it's just insane to think about, hey Reedy, you're going to do the World GPs and the U.S. Nationals. I mean, he would immediately quit or fire his agent or whatever. It's crazy. It's a massively underrated accomplishment. I believe you got fourth in the GPs, did you not?
Third.
So
yeah, that was the highest any American had ever placed at that time.
Right. At that time, the Euros were kicking everyone's asses. So, I mean, third place, you didn't race all the GPs. I imagine probably Gaston Rahier probably won. And
Gaston, he did win it, and I don't remember who got second, but I do know that the half the GPs that I was entered in, Steve,
mm-hmm.
I DNF'd in almost half of those events.
Because of the bike again?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Now, that's an underrated thing. I tell people about that, and they kind of go, yeah, whatever. But I'm like, no, you don't understand. He did that, both. And those are the days, too. Like, traveling wasn't easy in Europe. There's no internet. There's no cell phones. There's none of that. You know, there's smoking on the planes.
Yeah, it was brutal. It really was brutal. And to top it off, I hated Europe. I hated the people in Europe. The people in Europe gave me anything but a warm welcome over there.
Yeah, really, huh? Was it the whole throwing bottles at you and moving the fences
bottles,
and all that?
Throwing rocks, throwing branches, throwing mud, you name it. If they could pick it up and throw it at a guy, they would throw it at me. And, I distinctly remember this one race in Belgium, which was Gaston's home track.
Right.
And, you know, Gaston got the whole shot, and I got a second or third place start, and I worked up. And I came up, and I passed him on about the fourth lap or fifth lap.
Mm-hmm.
And I started pulling away, and you know, people were you know, throwing their arms at me and throwing their fists at me as I was going by. Well, my frame broke in half, and I didn't finish the race.
Right.
So in between motos, Steve Whitelock, which used to be the AMA director just
mm-hmm.
recently,
yep.
Well, he was the team manager for Europe, and Steve went to the FIM and said, "Hey, we want to check in this new frame.
Right.
Marty's frame broke. We got a brand new frame." Well, the FIM the Belgium FIM Federation
mm-hmm.
made up some new rule that said you have to ride each race with the same frame.
Oh, jeez.
Well, so I didn't get to ride the second moto. They didn't want me out there beating their Gaston in the second moto.
Right.
So I DNF'd that moto, and then, I think one time we were in France the year of the drought back in 76. No rain back there, and it was really dry and dusty. There was no water on the track. I had a 45-second lead the first moto and broke a chain. Fixed it, came out for the second moto, had a 30-second lead. Broke a chain again, DNF both motos that day. I should have won all four of those motos.
So,
we had a hell of a year that year, Steve.
You had a works bike in both continents, and it couldn't stay together.
No.
Oh.
And as it ended up, we didn't even finish the Nationals on a works bike. We did it on an FMF bike from Donnie Emler.
And it was better than the works one, I take it?
It was better, and it was worse. In some respects, it was better because it ran clean, but it just wasn't. It just didn't have the throatiness of that 125 factory bike. But at least it stayed together, and it was consistent. Now, my factory bike we had carburation problems. We had suspension problems. It was it was a mess. And then, I don't know if you remember, but about halfway through, Honda came out with a Type 2 factory bike.
No, I was four, Marty, so I don't remember.
Well, Honda came out with a new version of our works bike halfway through the season. And at Delta, Ohio, and I smoked everybody in both motos, right?
Yeah.
Bitching bike.
So you're like, cool, I'm set, right?
Yeah, and then Honda pulled it back and said, no, we're not going to let you ride this one because somebody tried to claim it after Delta, Ohio.
Oh, man. Yeah,
and
the claiming
Honda didn't want to lose that bike, so they took it back to Europe, and then that's when I was relegated to riding a production bike the rest of the year because our original factory bike was just such a piece.
Right, right. Oh, man.
Yeah, it was a tough year.
Yeah. So what was so different about the 76 model of the 75? Was it all new? Because the 75 was bitching, obviously.
Yeah, the 75 and the 74 was really bitching, and they made a bunch of changes. And in fact, it wasn't that they made so many changes. It's just the changes that they did make, nothing worked.
Mm-hmm.
They went backwards.
Was Dave Arnold your mechanic then?
Dave Arnold was my mechanic.
I want to have him on one of these. I'm going to chew his ass out.
you got to. Hey, you can't chew his ass out.
I'm kidding.
I know you are, but he did. He went to bat for me so much.
Right.
If it wasn't for Dave, we probably wouldn't even ended up second that year. Dave did above and beyond what a mechanic should do.
Yeah, really. Now,
he was awesome.
So straight up, you could have been world champion had you stayed all year and maybe the bike stayed together. I mean, you were better than Rahier. You really feel like that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't want to say that I was better than Gaston.
Mm-hmm.
Gaston, God bless him, is passed away from cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'd never want to say anything like that. But I could say that the outcome would have been a whole lot different if I had had a different bike and if I'd have rode the whole series.
Yeah, you ended up losing the 125 national title to some kid named Bob Hanna.
Yeah.
And you lost the world title. And, yeah, tough year. Again, a major accomplishment to me that you rode both. I just can't believe that back in those days. I mean, so I don't know. I mean, good on you, I guess.
That's why I had so much drive behind me in 77 to beat Hanna because, you know, he came in and beat me in 76.
Right.
And you know, I was one of these guys going to say, hey, look at our bike was a piece of crap. That's not my style.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, it is what it is. I got beat. I'm not going to look for excuses. But I'll tell you what, on every start line I was on the 77 500 class,
yeah,
it's all I kept thinking about is revenge. I want revenge.
How bad did it get between you guys? I know there was a massive rivalry, and he, you know how Bob is. His stories are legendary. I mean, was it pretty nasty between you two?
You know, on the track, it got pretty nasty.
Did it? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Like nowadays, the riders would probably be complaining, are you saying?
yeah. You know what? It might not have been to that point, but it was right very much close to that point.
Really?
Yeah. We had a whole lot of respect for each other out on the track. We
mm-hmm.
really did. And most people thought we hated each other, and actually on the track, I did hate Bob, and Bob hated me. And if it was any other way, we would never have been the fierce competitors that we are.
Right, right.
Because if you're a competitor in whatever sport you're in, you can't love your competition.
Yeah, I remember one time an interview with him. He said, you know, he it was hard for him because you were kind of his hero, and here he was. He had to hate you. You know what I mean? To beat you,
yeah.
Like he had to hate you. That was Bob. He had to get the hate on, and
yeah.
And it was tough for him.
and it's true. And knowing Bob, and knowing how he was off the track and on the track, it made me have a lot of respect for him because Bob was doing his job just like I was.
And it's funny that people, I mean, you're sort of legendary for your 125 prowess and coming on the scene and looking so good and, you know, being the epitome of California cool, but you won the 500 class in 77. And so you could ride the big bike too. Talk about the 77 season with you and Bob. I don't know too much about it as far as how it goes. Did you guys split the races? Did you beat him pretty good? How did it go?
Now, 77 was it was a bitching year.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it's bitching because I won, but the class,
yeah, exactly.
That championship was incredible. I jumped out to an early lead about the first three or four races,
mm-hmm.
and then the last half of the races, I had some crashes or bad starts or whatever. And Bob, it just worked out where I rode really well the first half and
mm-hmm.
had some mistakes and had some problems the second half. And Bob didn't ride as well the first half. He had some crashes, had some mistakes, and then he rode really good the second half. So it pretty much came down to the last race. I mean, you couldn't have scripted it any better, Steve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really.
And we both went down to St. Pete, and it was the final. And I think I had we might have been tied on points even. We might have been tied on points.
That was the sand track? Was that the gnarly sand track?
Yeah, it was one of the gnarly sand tracks. All the Florida tracks were gnarly. But
right.
We got down there, I don't remember. I think I might have got the hole shot, and Bob passed me, and I followed him. We were probably about a quarter, a third of the way through the track, through the heat, through the 45-minute moto,
mm-hmm.
and Bob's throttle cable broke.
Oh, man.
And so I just went around him, ended up cruising to the victory, the first moto, and pulled 25-point lead on him. So really the second moto, all they had to do was just motor around and finish. And that's what I did. Croft won. I think Hannah got second, and I got third.
And you were thinking to yourself, it was sweet revenge for the previous year when your bike couldn't stay together.
Oh, you know it, man. I was so stoked. And in that new DVD that I came out with this year, it's got a lot of that footage from St. Pete on there. And it's got me winning the, accepting my trophy there, mm-hmm. all live footage. And it just brings back so many memories.
We need to review that thing in Racer X. I don't know if we have.
I think when it first came out,
okay.
And I'm really grateful for Davey and Scott and all those guys that checked it out, because they gave it a great review, and really a common footnote that they all said is, your dad filmed it. First they would say, who the heck filmed this,
uh-huh.
Ryan? And I would say, well, it's my dad.
Yeah.
And they just said, my dad deserves so much credit, because all the footage is incredible.
Right. It's all really in focus and following you well and everything. Like
unbelievable.
Like Lucas directed it or something.
It's so bitchin'. Yeah, I had it all digitally re-enhanced, and it just came out incredible.
Right. Now, so 77 comes, and then 78, you had that crash in Houston. Was it Houston?
Yep.
I've seen it on a bunch of video footage. I think it's on my DVD, The World's Greatest Supercrosses, also. What an ugly, ugly crash. What happened? What went wrong there?
I got the whole shot. I was going into the first turn.
It was fast, too.
And, are you sure you're thinking about the Houston one, or are you thinking about the Coliseum one when I went over the bars?
Oh, maybe it was Coliseum. Yeah, I'm thinking when you went over the bars. Gnarly.
Yeah, that was a different event.
Oh, okay. So Houston, you dislocated your hip.
Yeah,
and it was
I had the whole shot,
mm-hmm.
and one of my I think it was my teammate Steve Weiss, and it was an accident, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Came in and took a bunch of us out in the first turn, and me being one of them, I was at the bottom of the pile and had my hip dislocated. So that was pretty much the beginning of the end of my career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I read that about that. You said it was incredible pain, huh? It was just gnarly.
Unbelievable pain.
Wow. And then, if guys do it now, but, you know, they're back racing, so I imagine the medical technology wasn't as great back then.
And they know a lot more about mm-hmm. how to treat a dislocated hip. When one of the most important things when you have a dislocated hip is to get it back in as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
Well, mine happened at 10 o'clock at night at the start of the main.
Mm-hmm.
The first mistake is AMA let the race go on. Being that I was like one of the top guys there, I was like top in points in Supercross that year.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'd just come off of a 500 championship. So, you know, I was one of the top guys, and if not the top guy. And then I go down in the first turn, and they let me lay there for the whole entire, main Supercross.
Really? You just laid there?
I just laid there. They had a medic there, and they wouldn't, mm-hmm. you know, they didn't stop the race. They should have stopped the race and got me out of there and got me some medical aid, like, right away.
Yeah, yeah.
And get this thing back in the position where it should have been in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I lay there for the whole race. They carted me off to the hospital. They didn't have facilities to put it back in. They didn't have the doctors there.
Mm-hmm.
Saturday night, the doctors are all out partying and shit, you know.
Who knows?
And until 5 a.m. in the morning, I laid with my dislocated hip out.
So 7 hours.
It was ridiculous.
Oh, man. So that was a tough injury to come back from, huh?
Impossible.
Yeah.
I just didn't have it in me.
Right. And so you kind of went through a couple of shaky years there, and you switched to Suzuki, your career on the way out. But you kind of did they just offer you a bunch of money? How'd that go down, to Suzuki?
After I hurt my hip in 78,
mm-hmm.
I rode a couple more events at the end of that year just to kind of stay on the bike. In 79, I rode for Honda again, and they, I mentally didn't recover from that injury,
yep.
And my heart wasn't in it. And after that year, Honda just said, "Hey, between the two of us, it was a mutual agreement. Hey, we're not happy with you, and I wasn't happy with what they're offering for me. I felt they should have gave me more for what I'd given them to that point." Yeah, so I had a bad year, big deal. But anyway, it didn't work out, and I went my way, and I was going to retire then.
Mm-hmm.
And Suzuki came up and gave me a great offer, and money-wise, so I took it and rode for them for 2 years.
Yeah, and did pretty decent, right? I mean,
I think you were all right.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't the top dog like I was with Honda, but you know, I was in the top five, and I won a few races here and there, but kind of like I said, it kind of was the end of my career where I just didn't have that drive anymore, mm-hmm. and that just happens.
I think when I think about your career and I look at it on paper, which is, you know, all I can really do because I wasn't around back then. I look on your career at paper and I think about, had you concentrated on one series in 77 or 76, had you not dislocated your hip, you know, I think your even though your career was impressive, it might have been a whole lot more impressive had you, you know, it seemed like you came and went pretty quick with that hip, you know. So.
Yeah, and it's nice for you to say that, and I do agree with you, but I also look at it like this. You know, I'm a firm believer in things happen for a reason,
mm-hmm.
and it just wasn't meant to be any longer of a career than it was.
Right.
You know, it was what it was, and my life is what it is now, and it might have been, my life now might be different if I ended up racing longer.
Yeah.
I might not have ended up meeting my wife or being with my wife, who I'm still with now, and have the kids that I have to this day and the life that I have right now. So
yeah.
I wouldn't want to change one second of my career.
That's a good way of looking at it, for sure. Yeah, you know, that's good. Your wife was a postal worker when I stayed with you.
She was, and now she's retired.
All right.
She's bringing home my retirement money now. I got it to this point now. She's going to carry us the rest of the way.
Yeah, exactly, huh? It was a great career. One of the old-timers told me that you were the first guy to get a $100,000 championship bonus. Is that true?
I wonder where that went.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't remember that.
Oh, okay. All right. That's what I heard. Somebody said Marty was the guy that really made big money. You know what I mean? You were the kind of the first guys to break the bank that way.
I did not get $100,000 championship bonus money.
Oh, okay. All right.
I might have got somewhere upwards of 50 or 75, but
yeah.
I know I didn't get 100 grand.
You're like, no way. When you retired, did you have a little nest egg put away? Were you all right? I mean,
yeah.
It was good.
I put a little money away, but you got to be really careful. And if I had any advice to give any of these up and coming riders, it would be you know, collect each paycheck like it's your last paycheck,
mm-hmm.
and invest it wisely because it goes very fast.
I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but there's not too many guys doing that these days.
Nope. No, they're buying trucks and cars.
Yeah.
Street bikes and shit, you name it.
Motorhomes. How about those motorhomes in the pits?
Yeah.
Those things are quite the sight. But, hey, thanks for doing this, man. I appreciate it. I'm pumped that you got to do this. You're one of the guys that, you know, legend in the sport. And like I said, I'm not old enough to remember you riding, but I know that I'm well aware of your status. So, thank you.
Well, I appreciate that. And then I appreciate you guys taking the time to want to even interview an old guy like myself.
Well, yeah, no, I know you had to get on there, and I really was hoping that you'd come on and be like, you'd tell everybody that I was only, you know, a couple seconds away from being a factory star, but that's okay, I'll settle with what you did. So once again, people can check out MartySmithMotocross.com?
Yeah, that's it.
All right.
And come to my schools, you're going to learn a lot.
Yeah, and hopefully I'll see you probably at one of the Anaheims, I guess, huh?
We'll see you at Anaheim 1, I'm sure.
All right, Marty, well, thanks very much, have a good night.
Steve, good to talk to you. And say hello. How are your parents?
They're good. Yeah, they're good. Thanks for asking. One lives on the west coast of Canada. One still lives in Winnipeg. So
they're not together. Wow,
not together. And my brother's still around. You know, he's living up in Winnipeg. So everything's good there. You know?
Excellent.
Yeah, thank you for asking.
Well, Steve, good to talk to you. And thanks for all the hospitality again. It was great.
Yeah, no problem, Marty. I'll see you around, man.
Take care, Steve.
Bye.
This has been the RacerX Podcast Show with Steve Mathis. Don't forget to check out some of our past shows with motocross legends such as the Beast from the East, Damon Bradshaw.
It got to the point where I didn't want to leave home, and once I got to the race, I wasn't into it. If I wasn't going to give 100%, I'm not going to take their money.
The working class hero, Doug Henry.
It was definitely an emotional moment for me, just thinking to myself, that's it, you know, and it's amazing the stuff that goes through your head in a short amount of time of the things that, you know, that I was going to miss.
The Dogger, Ron Lachine.
Until you really open your ears and you want to listen to what they're saying, it's like beating a dead horse, and, you know, and I know from personal experience, didn't anybody ever sit me down? Of course, everybody did.
Pro Circuit's Mitch Payton.
There's two ways to make the money. One is you can sign for money, or two, you can earn the money. I'm a high believer in earning the money. I think they ride better when they earn the money.
Seven-time Jeremy McGrath.
I was so mad, like so disappointed and so frustrated that I pulled the pick and I left. Every point counts. I could kick myself to this day for not just riding around in tents. It's been no problem. My ego got in the way, you know?
VO Show, Johnny O'Mara.
Stuff that you said that you didn't even want to ride it, you just wanted to just look at it all day. I mean, I got a chance to test all that. I like that era I was in. I really do.
Subscribe to the Racer X podcast show through iTunes to enjoy these and many more great podcasts. Why can't I just try? You know I've lost the blood. I'm a